IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Today is Thoughtful Thursdays for us. And as we do on Thoughtful Thursdays, we talk about a concept, a paper, or something that's intrigued us and that's led to a broader conversation about a certain framework. The topic for today's conversation is jointness, and jointness in the military in terms of operational, structural, organizational, and Sankalp will tell us a lot more. So I've got Sankalp and Suyash with me, and we're going to be talking about this. So just let's move forward now, Sankalp. What is this paper that you've read, and can you just sort of summarize the gist of the paper?
Okay, this paper was written by Aaron P. Jackson and published by Australian Defence College last year in 2018. The paper basically tries to theorize military jointness. Core argument of the author is that although military activities have become more joint, there is no theoretical base to explain those activities. That is why he has devised four criteria to sort of explain how we can evaluate military jointness. First criteria is operational, second is organizational, third is educational, and fourth is doctrinal. On these four criteria, author evaluates four Western militaries, US, UK, Australia, and Canada. And then he has this set of questions related to these four criteria. And then he sort of tries to analyze whether each military has achieved certain level of jointness or not.
Okay. Can you go into a little bit more detail? What do these four different things mean? I mean, what does doctrinal jointness mean? Operational seems fairly straightforward. But what does doctrinal jointness mean? What does organizational jointness mean? How do those actually play out in the real world?
Okay, so let me just start with explaining what is jointness.
Yeah.
Author simply explains that jointness is basically any military activity that involves two services.
Okay.
So say, for example, Army and Air Force would be doing something together, or Army or Navy. Core argument also relates to the rise of Air Force. He says that because of the rise of Air Force, the need for jointness has arisen in the modern military warfare.
Yeah.
So coming to the specific aspects of these four criterias, operational jointness would be something that, say, India tried to do in the Kargil war, okay, wherein Army was sort of helped by Air Force and they were planning their operations. In terms of organizational jointness, we have a command and control structure. Mm-hmm. I mean, not we don't have it, but we would imagine having a command and control structures which would plan things together and which will reduce the efforts put in by each services and sort of put in more harmony.
Okay. So that sort of entails some sort of a joint chiefs of staff, something like that, or a structure in which there is joint decision making among different forces, or there is one body which brings all this together to plan operations and to execute them. So the planning and executing of the operations, the actual that
higher defense management basically,
okay,
is, yeah.
Okay.
Third is educational. Educational is basically what we have with National Defense Academy, where cadets from all three services train together.
Yeah.
And also we have something like National Defense College, stuff like, you know, wherein senior military officers from three services would come in together,
yeah,
which would sort of help in furthering jointness.
Mm-hmm.
And the last is the doctrinal requirement, wherein the national security doctrine of a state will involve joint military activities by three services.
Okay. Okay, so that's an interestingly broad sort of set of things. At one level, you're not just training together, you're also planning together. Doctrinally, you're required to work together, and the vision is that you do work together, and that's based on that is how you sort of look to achieve your interests. And finally, how you end up executing all of them. So it's all these four different categories. Okay, that's fascinating. Does he talk about different parameters? Because each of these countries would probably have different levels of so-called jointness, because his definition is extremely loose, right? Just any activity between two forces. So what does he talk about when he talks about these four countries?
So he has these eight questions. Mm-hmm. Some of these questions are like, say, are there permanent joint operational command and control structures?
Mm-hmm.
Is there joint military education common?
Mm-hmm.
And these type of questions. Do they have a joint doctrine? And then he grades each of these four militaries, English speaking Western militaries. He emphasizes that. He says that they're culturally similar and, you know, their working methods are also sort of similar in some manner. That is why he selected those four countries. And he says that, you know, whether they are joint or not, we can evaluate based on these eight questions. So interestingly, on all of these questions, they are generally fairly joint, except on the question of professional military education, where US and Australia sort of lag behind UK and Canada.
Okay. So does he talk about whether jointness is a virtue in itself? Is it something to aspire for? Or is it a product of your interests, which will sort of then require you to... I mean, is jointness sort of the way forward for armed forces around the world in different countries? Or is it something that is that one must tailor based on one's interests and needs? And in some cases, it might not really be necessary. It might be wasted effort.
So the assumption behind this paper is that jointness is good.
Okay.
It will lead to efficiency. Mm-hmm. It will lead to reduced competition among services. And it will lead to more sort of operational effectiveness.
Okay.
So the author would like us to believe that jointness is good.
Okay. So Suresh, do you believe that this is necessarily good, or is it something which is based on a country's interest?
It is very subjective to particular country. For instance, India, a major criticism during Kargil war that Air Force and Army didn't operate together till a very long time, till the major portion of the war. This is mentioned in the Kargil Review Committee report. Does India need a joint operation, joint force, joint theater? What would be the role of Navy if there is a joint theater in the North? These are certain questions.
Isn't sort of competition between some of these different forces also healthy in terms of their survival? I mean, I understand that there will be friction and all that, but isn't it necessarily also for them to thrive also at certain points?
Yeah, there are two viewpoints to look at it. So one viewpoint is that, yes, it is healthy and it sort of leads to sort of, you know, better results. But then the author argues that with the experience of US in 1980s, that each service was sort of designing its operations and doctrines in such a way that will maximize the service interest rather than, say, the national interest. Although service was supposed to serve national interest, and that is where the need for jointness came in. And so they had this Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986, which paved way for the organizational and operational jointness.
But wouldn't this jointness lead to more fighting between services for who would be heading the operational part or functional part?
It should. That is what we would like to believe. But then what happens is that friction would be minimized in a, you know, if you have a proper organizational setup in terms of, you know, you don't feel like, say, you know, one service is sort of marginalized and the other is getting undue advantage. So that is something a nation has to balance while going for jointness. So there is this example of Canada herein. Canada in 1968 had a very adventurous defense minister, and he wanted proper unification, like complete unification. No individual service should remain in place. And he went for it. That was a disastrous decision because top brass of the military resigned, and then the overall Canadian Defence Forces suffered because of that enthusiasm for jointness. So there has to be this balance between, say, a service interest as well as requirements for jointness.
So I can see the need for jointness based on your threat perception and interest, right? Because if you look at the United States, the US has a diverse range of interests across a very vast sort of landmass, across a very vast area. It's not limited to its immediate periphery or its immediate sort of security. In comparison, if you see a country like, say, China or India, China, well, okay, let's keep China aside for the moment. Okay, let's look at India. Our interests are not as diverse and not as far in as far-flung areas. We don't need to be securing, lines in, say, in the Pacific Ocean. That's not our interest at the moment. Our interest immediately beginning to be the Indian Ocean in many which ways. But predominantly our interest is still sort of securing our borders, our land boundaries. I think in that case, the case for jointness becomes all the more difficult because if your immediate interest is the land boundary, while fully recognizing that the maritime domain is your future challenge, it's difficult to then assume a some sort of equality of forces, because you're inherently going to be investing more in your armed forces, in your army, as opposed to necessarily the Navy. So that conflict sort of remains. And then that sort of thing, sort of squaring the circle of jointness, becomes extremely difficult, right?
So interestingly, all these four countries, US, UK, Australia, Canada, that he has taken up for case study, are countries which don't face immediate land threats.
Exactly.
Although they conduct operations on land, their primary focus is naval operations. And India's case is completely different.
Yeah.
Immediate threats come from Pakistan and China. And so I'm not really sure whether India can go for the model of jointness that this paper talks about.
Yeah.
But there are some lessons in terms of, say, jointness, in terms of organizational aspects or doctrinal aspects, wherein India could think about, say, you know, moving slowly forward.
Okay. Okay. So let's look at those organizational and doctrinal aspects, and look at the fact that there is a country next to us which over the last 4-5 years has attempted something like this, right? So Suyash, you had something to say about how China is going about jointness.
I would also like to, before going to China, I would also like to add, you should include training into that. So one of the
training
major...
Training is there, no? Educational aspect?
No, you said organizational and doctrinal aspect. Training aspect, because one of the major recommendations from the Kargil Review Committee was to conduct joint training between Air Force and Army in case of India. Now coming to China, I had just had a word with Sankalp before the podcast that I was surprised to know why China is not included in the paper, and the paper was released last year, right? So paper was published last year. So something unique, if not unique, something interesting is happening in China. So China started 18th in the Party Congress, third plenum in 2003 is when China started to look at jointness. China, Xi took over and she and other leaders started talking about this. And the reforming of Chinese army started in 2015 and 16. But this was present in the scholarly debate since 1991. So from 1991 to 2010, there were scholarly debates happening regarding need of jointness. And the premise for this was the first Gulf War.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So 20 years, China's academia and journalists were talking about this. What China has done is they have developed 5 theater commands. So previously there were 7 MRs, that is military regions, which they have converted into theater commands. East, West, North, South and Central Theater Command. East is which overlooks Taiwan and the two seas. South for the South China Sea and Vietnam. West for Tibet, Xinjiang and India. North for Russia. And Central is the hub of all this, logistic supply for all this, or the head office for all these theater commands. So the head of all these theater commands, so for example, the head of Eastern Theater Command is a PLA Army personnel. A head of Western Theater Command is an Army personnel, and the head of Northern Theater Command is an Army personnel. South is headed by a person from PLA Navy, and Central Theater Command is headed by a personnel from PLA Air Force.
So what was the... So I can see that people, sort of the command structure was changed. What was the immediate need that the Chinese government felt to try and change from this military region approach to theater commands? I mean, what does the theater command entail?
The basic, one of the primary objective, and I quoted verbatim, China couldn't exercise unified command over joint forces without first establishing unified command system to command and control all PLA forces.
Okay, so they saw it as important to first establish a top-down leadership structure to then get operations occurring jointly. And that probably tells you a lot about the kind of frictions that exist between the different forces, the kind of thing that we were talking about.
I would like to give an interesting example, which recently was published in a newspaper, Chinese newspaper. You can analyze this as a need for jointness in training. So PLA Air Force and PLA Army were training together in Tibet. This comes under Western Theater Command. So the training was, PLA Army was mapping a site and PLA Air Force had to hit that site. Somehow there was a gap and PLA Air Force couldn't do that. That is why they decided to went for a joint training. And these PLA Air Force officers are working in Army right now for 2 years.
Okay.
So that they could understand the Army better.
Okay.
Now think of it. This could happen with an ease because Western Theater Command was responsible for this.
Yeah.
Now, hypothetically, if this have to happen in India, then there are so many acceptances. the headquarters, the theaters, the not the theaters, but the commands, then MOD, both the forces. So it would take much longer route, much longer time for this to happen. This is integration or easing up of the bureaucratic procedure.
So in some ways, this is creating a single command structure under which different elements of the different forces come into play, allows you to then identify gaps and then to be able to bridge those gaps without necessarily going through the bureaucratic hoops or you know, trying to explain to each other as to why you need to do certain things. Okay, Sankalp?
But just to sort of, you know, problematize what was we are discussing, although I might sound like I'm contradicting myself, but efficiency is not always good. So jointness entails efficiency. And as we are talking about China, they are also thinking about it. But say in terms of a war, an operational command breaks down. And in that case, at times, say individual services or say keeping MOD in loop might actually help in terms of such occurrences not happening again. But say with joint operational commands, if something goes wrong and there are no sort of in going for efficiency, we have just sort of removed duplication part.
Yeah.
Then that might also risk in, you know, like severe military cost.
No, but I'm not saying that they are not keeping their MOD, Ministry of Defense or CMC in loop. They are certainly keeping them in loop in case of training as well. But the power or the decision-making authority is the Western theater.
So the operational decision-making authority lies with that theater particular head, theater chief. And but obviously, yes, doctrinally, this is at the Central Military Commission level in China. That sort of makes sense. Okay, well, that's interesting. Let's look at India. So in the last couple of weeks or a month and a half or two, we've heard about this, the appointment of, I think it was during the Prime Minister's Independence Day speech, right? He spoke about the appointment of a chief of defense staff. Some people greeted that with a lot of enthusiasm. Some people greeted that with a lot of skepticism. We've already got an integrated defense staff, which does certain things, but a chief of defense staff would be completely different. And like we've seen, there's already going to be some sort of speculation about, well, who will take that post? Will it be from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and how that would change things? And also, would something like this sort of start to then systematically hinder certain kinds of development? So we've already seen a lot of conversation in India about a new aircraft carrier, and do we need one? Do we need to spend that money there and those sorts of things? Does a centralized joint sort of integration at that level promote jointness in operations and also jointness in terms of planning? Or does integration at that level, is it likely to sort of hinder some of this because the competition between the forces goes down?
Okay, so I think some context would be useful here. During the days of British Raj, they had something similar to Chief of Defense Staff. They had a single point military advisor to the Viceroy, who used to look after other forces in terms of overall defense of India. After independence as well, India was the first country to establish joint educational sort of training institute for military in NDA. But it was surprising that it was not followed up with other logical reforms in higher military management. Appointment of CDS has never been easy in any country. So there is this story about how Lord Mountbatten, when he became Britain's first chief of defense staff, his appointment was opposed by all three services. In fact, all three services detested him. And that was particularly the reason why he was appointed.
Okay.
Government sort of, you know, put its foot down and decided that, no, we should have chief of defense staff. So I think something similar will happen with India as well, that although services will have their own reservations, Army, you know, people always fear, say people from Air Force and Navy, that Army will dominate an integrated structure. But somewhere it has to start. So in that case, I think CDS would be useful in overall operational as well as organizational structure of India.
Okay.
I think CDS was long due. The scholarly community or the academia in India was saying that it is necessary to go for a CDS. But establishing only CDS would not help. It should be followed up with jointness in other parts. This is because if you see the primary structure of CDS, what Prime Minister Modi is talking about right now, it is at the same level with all the forces. And CDS is directly responsible to Modi. So he is ears of Modi in what is happening in armed forces. It took 20 years because Indian Air Force was obstructing this move. Now, since they are at the same level, it doesn't give CDS the command or the height to make decision. So only I think right now it would be regarding the scope of the CDS, current CDS, which the government is planning, would be regarding acquisition or maintaining a dialogue for acquisition, how to maintain the budget, how to divide the budget between different forces.
Okay.
It should be followed up by other reforms like training, jointness. So recently there was something in the news that India is thinking for new military doctrine. So these reforms should happen for CDS to function properly.
Also in terms of service headquarters having separate identity from MOD. So we are talking about reforms, then CDS, just cosmetic reform will not help. We will have to have integration at that level. Apart from integrated defense staff, we should also have service headquarters integrated with MOD. MOD looking after. So you have officers from all three services integrated there. Also in terms of competition, we have National Security Advisor. So will it sort of be, you know, will he be competing with, say, the new CDS?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Particularly if you come to the point of, say, doctrinally and for operationally, there could be certain conflict. But I mean, at the moment, if it's limited to the scope of acquisitions, which again is a large part of the friction between the three forces, because acquisitions entail a lot of finance. And that's where essentially the core of the sort of some of the biggest frictions.
Interestingly, acquisitions should lead to joint doctrine in the first place, or rather acquisitions should follow joint
should
doctrine.
Follow, yes.
Because based on your threat perceptions, you will start acquiring weapons.
No, but Hindustan Times recently reported that we are going for a joint doctrine, military doctrine. Interestingly, I am not so much worried about the NSA, but the defense secretary, because CDS is
better, no? Like defense secretary,
CDS is directly answerable to PMO, and you know the hold of defense NSA on the PMO. But in case acquisition, more or less acquisition comes under the defense secretary part. So his scope is directly intruded. So his area is poached right now. So will there be a friction between CDS and defense secretary, the current defense secretary? It is something to look forward to.
If the role of defense secretary is reduced, I think it's for better.
It's for better that we say, but think of you as a defense secretary. If you are a defense secretary, how would you react to it?
The bureaucracy will not like this. But I mean, armed forces have always detested the sort of kind of power the defense secretary enjoyed.
It is theoretically good, I agree. But if you are a defense secretary, then how would you react?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should be worried about what the personal feelings of the defense secretary are. But yeah, I mean, you can see that there could be potential friction in this process. But given the fact that CDS would have direct access to
just one issue I wanted to flag in terms of overall India's structure of jointness. So just one example we can see is Army has its own aviation wing, Air Force has their own planes, and Navy has its own aviation. So should we go for jointness, should we not go for jointness, and if we go for jointness, then what happens with these three separate sort of, you know, air forces in a way? And that is the kind of question that CDS will have to sort of start discussing now.
Yeah, and that has to then eventually flow from your threat perception and the doctrine of how you sort of are going to approach your threats and how you're going to sort of pursue your interests. So while this might be one institutional arrangement that you create, what's important is to identify doctrinally the need for jointness and where and how you would pursue this. And that, I think, is one of the big sort of takeaways that I would have from this conversation. Thank you so much, Sankalp. Thank you so much, Suyash, for joining us. And if you have any comments, please do leave them for us in the comment section. And do keep listening. Thank you. If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaINST or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.